14th episode of the Loose Threads podcast, a show about the intersection of fashion, technology, and commerce. Joining me today is Sep Skerritt, the founder of Proper Cloth, a company using tons of data and technology to make customized men's apparel affordable and accessible. Proper Cloth is one of those companies that has both the technical and creative chops needed to thrive today. My talk with Sep focused on the attention to data and detail that makes Proper Cloth what it is, and the journey from what some considered a stupid idea to the ever-expanding company that exists today. Here's my talk with Sep Skerritt.
I'd love to kind of start by talking a bit about kind of your background and maybe before Proper Cloth existed, what were you working on and kind of back our way into Proper Cloth.
Yeah. So first of all, electrical engineering is what I studied in school. And the first job I had out of school, I was a systems engineer at a defense contractor. So very early on, I was designing technology, building technology, leading technology team. And I got experience putting systems together, integrating things, making things work. So that was my first 3 years. In addition to that, I had started a company in college that was a party event planning marketing business. Basically, when I was 19, started throwing events, throwing parties. They turned to bigger and bigger. We started marketing them more, became huge Halloween events or New Year's events, turned into a nightclub promotions business. So I had this experience from college of building a brand around that lifestyle company and marketing to younger people and doing design for marketing materials or the website, and even that started to become design for t-shirts and materials like that. So I had experience doing marketing, experience doing branding, experience doing design, and then I had this technology background. So then I was kind of like, what's the right move for me next? And I didn't like the defense contractor work. It was too slow. So I applied to business school. I went to business school in Boston. And while I was there, I was just business planning and just kind of trying to think of what company to start. And so it was while I was in grad school that I came up with the concept of Proper Cloth. And that's kind of the background from before.
Word. And how long did it kind of take to come up with that concept? And what was that kind of process like? And also maybe give us a little context of like what time that was in kind of this whole luxury landscape.
Yeah. So I started grad school in 2006 and I did a summer internship in Shanghai that summer. So it was like summer 2007. And while I was in Shanghai, just as a tourist, I got custom shirts and custom suits made. My host there took me out. It was kind of a fun thing to do. And I just remember thinking like the experience of getting that custom product was really kind of groundbreaking to me. Like my experience before that of buying dress clothes was going to the mall or going to a department store and trying on some stuff off the rack and nothing really fit right or the style wasn't right or the color wasn't right. But you know, you had to wear that stuff for your work. So you kind of just took whatever was the best compromise you could find and, you know, moved on with life. And that was that. And when I got custom, it was like, you just told the guy what you wanted and you got it. And it was like that easy. And the sky was the limit. If you had a better idea of what you wanted, you could get that too. So I thought, what a cool experience. And it wasn't an experience that was available to me before I had gone to Shanghai. So why can't that be more accessible? And so that was the initial concept. And at the time, Gilt Group was really taken off. We were early in this direct consumer stuff, but people were beginning to really accept that, okay, you can sell clothes online. That was kind of a new thing even in 2006, 2007. People would put their credit cards online, shop online. Oh, they'll buy clothes that you have to try on or touch. So my initial concept kind of fed from that and was that, what if you take that custom shirt experience and you do it really, really well with e-commerce? And through that, we can make it more accessible. And by making it more accessible location-wise, so you don't have to go all the way to Shanghai to get it, or you don't have to go to New York or a big city to get it, make it more accessible price-wise because we're going to be direct consumer. So we're cutting out a lot of that extra price that makes Nordstrom's or Bergdorf Goodman's custom clothing just prohibitively expensive. And let's make a brand that's more accessible. Like a lot of the brands of custom clothing previously were very old-fashioned, very pretentious, and not the kind of brands that I would ever shop at. So those three things were kind of being combined in this concept for Proper Cloth.
Totally. Yeah, I remember like hearing from like distant uncles of those trips to Asia or somewhere, and they would do them, but it was always like they were over 50, and it was almost like an older generation of thing of where you would kind of have the pre-fitting suits, and then if you got to a certain point in your life or career, you'd go, okay, like it's custom time,
right,
and then kind of
right.
go do that. And so it sounds like this was an opportunity to kind of bring that high level, maybe even stuffy experience sometimes all the way down to people that are of a much younger age and
right.
kind of growing in their profession.
Yeah, normal millennial guys that have to wear nice clothes for work or, you know, care about how they look but aren't so obsessed in wearing ascots every day either. You know, just kind of like average guys that want shirts to fit right.
Definitely. And is it also fair to say that custom was more formal at that point also, right? That you had custom for suits or tuxes or stuff like that, but there was also, and I don't know if this was kind of the thesis early on or this kind of just happened, but custom kind of started to trickle down into the more casual wear and kind of into more everyday clothing.
Yeah. At the time, custom was definitely a business thing. That was the idea. And that seemed to be where the demand was. And definitely in my initial thinking, the initial business plan, it wasn't like we're going to sell a ton of custom casual sports shirts. That came later. That evolved out of, personally, that's what we were wearing in the office or what I was wearing. And it ended up being more fun and a little more interesting and creating a little more excitement too with those more unique casual products. So that wasn't our initial idea, but it came on and it grew nicely as a result.
Definitely. And so this was started in 06.
Yeah, so I was like business planning in 2007. In 2008 was the year I graduated. I was kind of taking it a step further. I found a developer that would work on contract. I found a factory, a shirt factory down in North Carolina that would make shirts, you know, one at a time like we needed. And with leftover student loans and credit cards, cobbled together a website that was kind of a proof of concept. And in October 2008, so-called launched. It was a very soft launch. There was no venture capital announcements. There was no big marketing push. It was sort of a quiet, I'll email everybody I know and point them to this website and see what happens. And that was 2008, yeah.
And how'd that end up going? Or,
you know, our story's like pretty humble beginning, that's for sure. So friends and family bought some shirts, maybe just to show support, got some feedback, made some mistakes, corrected some things. They told some of their friends, picked up maybe another couple customers there. Over the next like three, six months, I was pretty focused on the product as a technology product, and so was putting a lot of energy into SEO, search engine optimization, and we started to find some customers would find us through that. And then got a little bit of press. We had a nice GQ article kind of early on in our history and a few other things that helped total strangers find us and give us a try. And then once you had enough kind of a steady stream of people that you didn't know buying your product, and not a big stream at all, like just, you know, handfuls of things happening, it was at least enough proof of concept to convince friends and family to support a little further. And so then I was able to do a small friends and family round, like just $100,000 to keep the lights on, so to speak, while I kept focused on improving the service and product.
Definitely. And when you look back at kind of where the brand, the kind of positioning, the product was at that point, how would you kind of describe it? And is it at all different from where it is kind of today?
Well, it's very similar. The initial concept is still relatively the same. The initial concept was, like I said, we're going to make custom shirts. We're going to do it accessible. We're going to make it great value. We're going to just be the best at delivering this product online. That hasn't changed. I think the brand has evolved in the sense that we got more polished. The look and feel of the website has improved in a million ways. We went from myself photographing fabrics in my bedroom to great photography all across the site to now we're shooting lookbooks in Iceland and going to great locations and working with great models, and we're, you know, really working with the best in that area. So our branding and the look and feel of the brand has definitely improved in huge ways, but the kind of initial concept and core brand personality, I think, is consistent.
Definitely. So I'm curious what it was like to kind of have that first conversation with that factory in North Carolina when it sounds like, you know, there was almost nothing yet, right? But
yeah,
like it's coming or something's going to come.
Yeah, that was a funny story, actually. So I'll never forget, there was a guy named Bill Sand there that was the manager of that factory. And I went to him, you know, how do you even find a factory like that? You know, I'm just calling everybody I know, Googling stuff. One guy says, call this guy. Somebody, he leads you to someone else. Next thing you know, I'm talking to this guy in North Carolina. Told him my idea, told him who I was, and his reaction was just like, listen, like, let me do you a favor. Like, don't start this company. This is not going to work. Like, I've seen this before. There was another guy a lot like you. He was at Stanford, smart guy. He tried to start this exact same business. It didn't work. He lost a lot of money on it. Like, talk to him. And so it was just like a real kind of like, you don't want to do this sort of response, but still kind of supportive. At the same time, that factory needed business. We're going to 2008. The economy is like really slowing down. They were desperate for orders. They weren't really going to turn away business per se, but it was funny that their first reaction was like, this is a bad idea. Don't even bother trying. But I talked to that guy that he suggested I talk to and heard his side of the story, but stuck with it regardless. And then we set things up with that factory and we got it going. I should add, they were a factory that specialized in doing made-to-measure shirts. They were not a bulk factory that I had to convince to do made-to-measure shirts. And that was one of the core, that was like a kind of important thing about the industry, was that custom shirts already existed before we started. We didn't have to figure out the manufacturing of custom shirts. People were already making shirts one at a time for made-to-measure customers. My initial idea was to innovate on the front end, on the user experience of ordering the product, on the way we would market it, on the way we deliver it. So, and I was, at least in the initial stages, very happy to just plug into the same back-end production that other traveling tailors would use or other boutique menswear shops would use. So they already were making shirts one at a time. So that wasn't like, I didn't have to convince them that part anyways.
Gotcha. And so, what are the economics of custom made? On the one hand, it was really expensive, right? When you were not in Asia, I guess. But then also where you started was domestically. And so I'm curious kind of what were the economics like at that point, and then have they at all shifted?
For made to measure products, fundamentally, it does cost a little bit more to sew the product. And that CMT portion of the production does cost a little more, fundamentally. Secondly, you are often buying smaller amounts of fabric, so you are paying more for the materials as well. Third of all, there's often a lot of more hand-holding and management required to take it from the order to finished product. And then you have shipping of the product, and if you're shipping one thing at a time, that's more expensive than shipping a bunch of things in a box and unpacking them in a store. So I guess you have all those things that add up to make the product ultimately more expensive in some ways. That being said, as we've scaled and as we've built our business, we've really attacked all that cost associated with managing the order and processing the order and basically using all sorts of technology to streamline that, both to make it faster and secondly, to make it so that we don't need a huge back office of people rubber stamping order forms. And so we were able to save a lot there. We've scaled the business quite a bit. So now, as far as purchasing fabric goes, we're purchasing fabric in very large quantities. So we're getting real economies of scale there as well. We're shipping in very large volumes. So we're getting great rates with international shipping. So by really focusing on the category and the way to approach it, a lot of those costs that, like, say, a traveling tailor might have when he's really literally doing one shirt at a time and he's manually doing it himself, we've been able to streamline so much of that to make both the delivery faster and the cost of delivering the product cheaper.
Definitely. Yeah, that makes perfect sense. And so first few months were slowly building, and then you kind of raised that first friends and family round. And then what kind of progressed after that?
I mean, it was slow and steady from the beginning to now. 2009, our first full year, was a small year for us, but from that point, we have consistently doubled in size every year. So doubling from a small amount to a slightly less small amount is one thing, but like over time, that sort of snowballs until you have really starting to get somewhere. So we never had a major breakthrough where we grew 10x one year. It's almost remarkable how steady that sort of trend of 2x each year plays out. And through that time, I think the key thing that we've been good at is focus and not being distracted with shiny ideas and trying to like do some new partnership. We've just been very focused on how do we improve this experience of ordering the product? How do we improve the customer service around it? How do we improve the technology to make it more streamlined for the customer or more streamlined for our operations? How do we improve our fabrics? How do we improve the shirts themselves? How do we improve our brand? We've just been so focused on those things that we're just iteratively one-upping each of those areas over time. And of course, acquiring customers over that whole time as well. So that's been our growth trend so far, and that's what's worked for us.
Yeah, it's always interesting to me how much kind of people underestimate that building any sort of fashion apparel brand is like minimum 10-year endeavor. And there maybe are shortcuts, but in the end, you kind of have to still go on that time horizon anyway.
Well, I think with a lot of venture capital, like maybe you can shortcut some things or make mistakes, bigger mistakes too, but yeah, that's been our story anyways. It's been, we're 8 years now. It all worked out so far.
And so I'm curious to talk a bit about kind of the products then over those past 8 years in terms of you started with shirts as kind of
shirts,
the core.
Yeah.
And looking at the website now, it seems like it's expanded quite a bit beyond that.
Yeah, shirts is our core and shirts still is our core. And we've added other products, but shirts is still the core. One thing that we realized sort of midway through was that we need to be an aspirational menswear brand. Like we're not going to be just a shirt company. I don't think we can get to where we want to be by just selling shirts. One, I want to do lookbooks. I want to show men wearing the product in a full outfit. And then I'm not going to show the full outfit if only the shirt is our product. So I want to have all the products so I can show complete looks and kind of really start to show this lifestyle of what this person looks like and wears and does. So for that reason, I need other products. Also, yeah, people come to the site, they're looking for shirts, but yeah, they might want to get a tie as well. So it doesn't hurt to have the other products. And then third, it's fun and it's interesting to us. We like making cool stuff. So designing a tie and working with a factory in Italy to make a tie and making that beautiful and awesome and being the exact tie that you would want to have. That's just kind of a fun project for us. We just do that for our own benefit almost. So we're doing a lot of these other products almost as passion projects. They complement the brand. They help us. They tend to be good ways for us to tell our story about what our brand values are. So the craftsmanship that goes into those products, the materials that goes into those products, the people that make those products, those tend to always be great stories that I think reflect our values as a brand. And so there's reasons that we want to do them, but shirts is our core and we always add new other product categories tentatively and nervously that it's going to distract us from the core that's really like driving what we're doing.
Totally. I'm curious what the design process is like for a product and kind of what happens in-house, what happens at the factory, and then I guess in a way also how you design for custom.
Yeah.
Especially, I guess, on the sizing front.
Yeah. Well, there's so much to talk about on the product side of things. Yeah. And I think one of the things that I really is important that, maybe before I get into that, I should talk about just fundamentally how custom is different than off the rack. And I think there's like some inherent advantages to doing custom and there's some inherent challenges to doing custom. Advantages are we don't have the same inventory risk as people that are selling products off the rack. We take inventory in fabrics, but having 1,000 meters of fabric is much less risky than having 500 shirts
right.
in like specific sizes.
Right, because you have total optionality of what
right.
the fabric can turn into.
So we don't have inventory risk. And on top of that, we always have your size available. We can always give you exactly the size and style you want. You want that spread collar with a pocket and it's in your perfect dimensions. Like, we got that. We're never out of stock of your size. So those are two kind of fundamental advantages we have as custom. Disadvantages are, yeah, it might cost more. It might take longer. I think one of the main disadvantages is that you can't see and touch and feel the product because it hasn't been made yet. But obviously, when you're in e-commerce, that doesn't matter because people are only looking at pictures anyways. And we use 3D rendering software to give you an idea of what the product will look like, which is almost the same as you get shopping at Barneys.com anyways. So we have that sort of disadvantage goes away in e-commerce. Cost and price, we're direct to consumer. We're streamlining everything with technology. We're pushing down on that speed. You know, it used to be 4 or 5 weeks to get a custom shirt. Now we're on a very steady 2 weeks. We're pushing to like 11 days on average. We're starting to get to the point where if you order that on Barney's, you might not get it for 6 days. Yeah, you wait an extra 5 days, you get it from us. Like we're starting to be competitive in terms of speed with other e-commerce companies. So fundamentally, made to measure, we have these cool advantages that we don't have inventory risk and we can always sell you exactly what you want and the challenges are going away. So I think we have that kind of key advantage to what we're doing. In addition to that, on the product development side, how we go about creating the styles, I think one of the key things that we do that has really worked out for us is the way we use technology to drive those decisions. To explain that more, one of the unique things about Proper Cloth's relationship with our customers is we know exactly what product every customer's bought ever. And not just what product, but I know if you bought a shirt in 2014, I know exactly what fabric it was used, and I know exactly what the construction of that fabric was, what the pattern of that fabric was, how many ply it was, what the weave was. I know every dimension on that fabric, not just like some brands might know that it's a spring summer 14 medium, but I know the chest width is 21.25, the shoulder width 17.75, it had a half inch shoulder slope. Right? I know everything about the dimension of that product. I know what collar style you had, I know what pocket style you had. We had this very intimate relationship with our customers where we know exactly everything they own from us, what it is. And then on top of that, we are very aggressive about getting feedback from customers and surveying them. How did you like this? How do you like that collar? How do you like this fabric? And by knowing exactly what your customers have and then collecting a lot of data about what they like and what they don't like, you start to get real insights into what's working and what's not working. And so we do this in all areas of the product development, but fabrics in particular, for example, we ask every customer how they rated a fabric on performance and feel and like how comfortable it was, and also on how look and kind of pattern, like color and pattern. And so we take that data, and by the way, we want this data so much, we give customer store credit for answering these surveys. So it's like $5 for every fabric you rate. Like, and so we're really incentivizing customers, and we get tons of feedback. Some fabrics will have thousands of reviews. And it helps us identify immediately if a fabric has low ratings, we know immediately that something's wrong. Like that fabric is either something's wrong, it's just a bad fabric, or more likely we're describing it wrong. Maybe the photograph makes it look blue, but it's really slightly lavender. Maybe we're saying it's wrinkle resistant, but it's really not that wrinkle resistant. And we're able to correct it, the descriptions of the photos to get it right, or discontinue it quickly and pull it if it's not right. But even beyond that, for example, on the basic stuff, like a white shirt, where you or I might have two different white fabrics, right? And we, as designers, could debate for hours about which one's better. And, you know, this one's a 80s two-ply pinpoint. This one's an 80s two-ply twill. This one's a little shinier. This one's a little less shiny. This one is a little thicker. This one's a little more, less opaque. We could be debating for hours about which one's better. Who can decide, right? But with the data, when we start to have thousands of reviews on both of those, that's when you start to see, oh, this one's a 4.34. This one's a 4.64. You start to say, oh, this one actually just quantitatively is better. And that drives a lot of our decision-making on the product development process. That lets us know, okay, this one that's lower, we're going to either move it to the back so that it gets less orders and more orders go to this one that gets higher ratings, or we're going to discontinue it over time, or the one that's getting high ratings, let's create more colors of that same style. Let's do patterns in that style. Let's use that same construction because it gets high ratings. So we're doing this data-driven, iterative product development where we're using this close relationship we have with the customer to figure out what's working, figure out what's not working. And over time, you know, then I have this 4.64 rated fabric. I might try another fabric. Oh, here's another construction. It has a slightly different finish on it. Let's sell, you know, 200 shirts like this and see if the rating's even higher than the other one, or if it's the same, or if it's lower. And then, you know, if it's higher, okay, hey, we got a new favorite. Let's push that and let's move towards that. If it's lower, okay, we'll discontinue it. So technology and that data really drives a lot of our product development process, particularly for custom product. you have collar styles, you have cuff styles, you have buttons, you have all these different components that you've designed and give the customer so that they can combine in their own ways to produce their own product. The fabrics ends up being like one of the core things where it's like, okay, what's really new? Customer often finds like he likes this collar, he likes this cuff, he has this particular style of shirt that he just likes to get, and he's not going to change that. But the fabrics is where that's where a lot of our design comes in. For example, last year alone, we launched 460 new fabrics. We'll have 500.
That's a lot of fabrics.
Yeah. We'll have 500 plus available at any one time. Over 50% of the fabrics we launched in 2016, we custom developed ourselves. They were made for us. These are not like some stock fabrics from some mill. These are fabrics we designed. We designed the pattern. We particularly specified the construction and the finish. And so we've been able to really kind of over time up our fabric ratings. And we were reviewing this the other day. You can literally see quarter over quarter, our average fabric ratings just creeping up, just slowly creeping up. And I think that's driven by that data and that process around that.
Definitely. I mean, it sounds like you've kind of taken that mentality of custom, right? Which is going from pushing pre-decided options to a customer and then pulling it from them and kind of embedded that in the entire way you kind of approach product and in the business as a whole.
Yeah, I mean, it's all about data. I mean, my background's in engineering, and I think one of the key things is we've broken the product down. The shirt product is broken down to a collar, a cuff.
Right, it's entirely modular.
It's entirely modular, exactly. And fundamentally, our architecture, our database architecture is such that we have all that information in a way that we can break it down and make sense of it. I don't think any other retailer has that sort of visibility into which collar style makes a customer more satisfied or which button correlates to lower reviews or which like I was saying about fabrics. I don't think any other retailer has that. Definitely not if you're not selling online, you don't have that. If you're selling other people's brands, you have no idea because you don't know the products that well. And even if you're selling your own brand, I don't think most retailers are structuring their systems in a way where they have that visibility. So I think that's a major advantage we have and leverage pretty hard.
Definitely. Are there such thing as silhouettes in custom, or how does like sizing and grading work when?
Oh yeah. Size, man, size is a big deal. Yeah. I mean, obviously, and actually kind of going back to the original concept, that's one thing that we've maybe slightly changed our attitude on. When we started, I think the concept was, oh, you can design your own shirt, and that's going to be a big part of the value proposition. You can choose this collar and put this contrast fabric here and choose that cuff. But what we've kind of moved towards is the fit is the real value proposition. The customer wants a perfect fitting shirt. And there's customers out there who want to design their own product and put like some funky looking something here, and it kind of has a lot of personality for them. That's great, and we definitely do that, but I think there's a larger market of guys who are looking for someone to suggest some appropriate styles, or they just want classic white shirts, either way. So we've moved towards designing our own collections and pushing our own collections as kind of almost as finished products is how they look. And you shop for those styles online in the exact same way you shop on Mr. Porter. You just find the shirt and choose your size and add to your cart. But we put a ton of energy and work into the custom fit. When we started, the way someone created their size was they would measure their body at home, they'd follow some videos and enter in their dimensions, and then that would calculate a custom size for them. Later, we added the option where they could measure their own shirt at home and kind of copy the size of an existing shirt they had, which worked okay. We also made it so that you could mail in a shirt to Proper Cloth, and then we would measure your shirt for you and save that size in your profile. We still do all those things. They all work okay, but there's definitely like a lot of work for the customer to do that. And that was preventing us from growing like we wanted to grow. So one of the major innovations we had was when we developed what we call smart sizes. And the idea behind smart sizes is a lot of people are comfortable buying sizes in off the rack. You go to most websites, you order the shirt in size medium, right? And that seems to work okay for a lot of people. If you tell me you're medium, I have a good idea of what size you are and what dimensions you want. And then we kind of added on that, well, hey, if I know you're a medium and I know how tall you are, if I know you're medium and you're 5'7", I know your sleeves are probably shorter than if you're a medium that's 6'3". So I can make the size a little bit more intelligent if you give me those two data points. And then it was like, well, if you also tell me how much you weigh, and then if you also tell me if you tuck your shirts in, or if you also tell me what sort of shape you're in, or if you also tell me your ethnicity even, I was able to use those data points to make even better size suggestions. And so we developed this smart sizes technology where we ask you 10 questions, and the idea is every question is the kind of question that most guys just know. Nobody knows what their chest measurement is around or how wide their shoulders should be, but they know how tall they are, how much they weigh, you know, some of these basic things. And I created these equations that would calculate and predict your perfect size. And that tend to work pretty well in the beginning. Over time, as we started to really get scale, we started to get lots of, you know, we started to have lots of customers. We started to have really rich data with customers who have answered all those questions, and then over maybe multiple iterations even gotten to a size, a custom size, where they were like, this is my perfect size and I love this fit. And so then Smarts has kind of evolved from a common sense logic of taller people have longer sleeves and shorter people don't, and, you know, common sense logic equation, to something that's entirely data driven and based on a very large data set. So right now, I think the last time we updated was version 19. We update this pretty regularly. For example, we have like over 60,000 total clients today, but we maybe filter that down to 15,000 that we had clear indicators that their size was perfect and we had their smart size responses. And then, so we have thousands of these data points, and then we're able to look at those data points and use that to train this algorithm in a way that now common sense is out the window. Now you're purely just looking at data. I don't even care what the question was. I'm just looking at what your answer was and how that correlates to your end result dimensions. And so we've been refining that with this analytical approach and getting it to be even more and more effective. So now, fundamentally, on average, your error is zero, which is hard to explain how well this works. But fundamentally, on average, your errors are always zero. So you start to focus on what's the standard deviation of your errors. And we found we got every dimension now is standard deviation is less than 0.9 inches. Most standard deviations are less than half of an inch. What that means is if you answer those questions, there's standard deviation 68% either way. So there's a 68% chance that every dimension on that shirt is going to be within 3/4 of an inch of what's perfect, of what you end up, what ends up being perfect for you, which for most guys is like way better than they've ever got off the rack ever. And so they're super happy there and maybe satisfactory in the end. But even if it's not totally perfect for them, we've also really ramped up our alteration process and our customer service process. So we streamline that and make that whole remake process super easy for customers. And we really work with them to fine tune it. And if you can get the first one very close, getting to perfect becomes much easier. It's like, okay, I'm going to take a half inch out of the midsection and I'm going to add 1/4 inch to your sleeve length. And now you're good.
Totally. I guess one of the biggest kind of untapped dreams I feel like in apparel is this idea of total customization, right? Yeah. Where a person comes to you with this idea for a product and it just kind of gets made. That has largely not happened in a way for maybe a bunch of various reasons. Custom, on the other hand, seems to exist within some sort of parameters while also delivering a ton of just pragmatic value in a way for the customer. Why do you think that is happening? Because it's on that path towards total customization, but it's not like going to someone with a roll of fabric and a blank pattern and just being like, we want to do this.
Yeah.
And I've always been kind of perplexed by it because to me, it seems like the supply chain, the manufacturing is really not there to do a totally custom product at scale.
Yeah.
But it seems that, for example, like men's essentials custom is starting to get on that path.
You know, I think it's always might seem like it's starting to get on that path, but I don't think you ever get to total custom. And I think that's kind of just a matter of understanding and or how things look. You know, it's like you have this similar stuff playing out with artificial intelligence these days. People imagine these robots that are going to just talk and look and, you know, be like able to do anything. But the people developing artificial intelligence are actually very specialized. You have X.AI that's purely focused on making a robot that can schedule meetings for you. And they'll put a ton of energy into scheduling meetings in a very flexible way so that it feels natural. And if you combine that with a million other different people's efforts you can start to feel like, oh, wow, this thing can do anything. But it really can't. It's right. just really it, good at
the things. It's a domain-specific application.
Right.
Yeah.
And so we'll probably continue to add to custom shirt options. And to a, we'll get to a point eventually where people will probably be like, oh, yeah, you can do anything on the shirt. You can basically tell them, I mean, you can basically tell us exactly what size you want the product. Any dimensions are fine. You know, put in your dimensions, change your shape to however suits you. No problem. Totally flexible there. Collar styles, you got a bunch to choose from, so you can get pretty much any collar you want, you know, a bunch of other options. For a lot of people, they would say, oh, anything's possible. As far as their imagination goes, anything's possible. But it's not really like anything's possible. It's just like right. enough's possible that you get everything you would want and then you stop asking for more.
Right. And do you think anything has to do also with the idea that just people don't always know what they want and that you need to give or kind of create some sort of parameter for them to exist in, as opposed to just giving them a, like a totally blank canvas?
Oh, that's definitely true. And I mean, that was a fundamental thing for us. In the beginning, we started with, if you wanted to buy a shirt from us, you had to design it. And even then you had limited parameters, but that was overwhelming for a lot of people. Now we start with, here's our suggested shirts. Here's the shirts from our last collection. And they're going to be made to order. They don't look like they're going to be made to order, but they're going to be made to order. And, you know, that's an easier shopping experience for most people. And yeah, I agree.
Definitely. Are there examples, or do you think that custom like this works for women, or is it much easier to solve for men's apparel?
You know, we get asked that a lot. Frankly, I don't know. I mean, I know for a fact there's women that want custom shirts. We get asked for that all the time. But I do question the market size. I do question, I think there's some fundamental things like that I could just be wrong based on my own stereotypes. But I think a lot of our customers, men, wear dress shirts every single day. And so once they have the fit right, they want to get several.
Right.
And so you have like a value of a customer there that can be high. Women, I think they dress with a lot of different outfits. A lot of them do.
Right. So it's less of a uniform.
Yeah. I'm sure there's exceptions to this, that girls that would wear the same, would wear a dress shirt every day if they could. But if you had a lot of customers who were only buying one, your sort of fundamental economics might not work the same. And then, you know, I think there's just a lot of guys who dress this way and a lot of women just don't wear shirts like this. So I think the market could be smaller. I'm sure there's something to be done there for shirts. I know there's been women's custom women's dresses companies, and there's a custom women's shoe company. I think Shoes of Prey does fairly mm-hmm. well. From what I can tell, they seem to be doing great. I don't think any of the apparel companies have really lasted, from what I can tell. I could be missing something, though. But we don't plan to expand into women's in the near future, mainly because I think it's a branding. It's a little challenge to do the branding and to kind of sell both to women and men at the same time. I think we have our hands full building a men's lifestyle brand, so we're focused on that for now.
Definitely. I'm curious to talk a bit about kind of retail in the showrooms, which we're sitting behind one of them right now, and kind of how that came into play and kind of what the vision is there.
Yeah, the showroom was not part of the original business plan. The showroom kind of evolved out of necessity. We were here in New York, and in the very early days, working out of an incubator. We didn't even have our own office space. And customers would see that you're in New York, and they'd phone and ask if they could come see the stuff in person. And you don't want to turn a customer away in the early days, but you know, even or ever, right? So you say, yes, come by. And then you were showing them fabrics in a conference room, or, you know, just in a terrible experience. And so it was just like, this is not on brand as far as I'm concerned. And there's a decent number of people that want to come in. So basically we evolved into having a showroom because there was requests to come visit and see stuff in person. And that being said, the showroom's been a huge success. Lots of people want to come in. I think New York is obviously one of the great markets to be in, and we happen to be here, so sure, why not? It's also a great chance for us to translate our brand from an online brand to a more physical brick and mortar feel, which is a fun challenge and I think connects with people that come in the way that you don't necessarily get just by visiting a website. So that's been good. That being said, our business model and our strategy, at least for now, is not, we don't plan to add more stores. I think, like I said earlier, I think focus is key, and I'm sure adding stores makes sense at some stage for us, but I think there's a lot more that we can do purely for reaching people online. And frankly, we just have our hands full with managing all these different web updates and improvements and ideas that we have there. A customer service team that's focused on supporting people over email and phones and not in person. The digital marketing that drives a lot of this, optimizing that. It seems to us that there's so much opportunity to scale as an online business, and we haven't plateaued there. And our plan is to continue to focus on that until we maybe find that we can't get that next customer to shop online. Maybe we will, and then that strategy could shift. But at least for now, that's where we see it.
Definitely. I'm curious to talk a bit about kind of how you decided to finance the company and kind of, it sounds like forego that venture capital path that a lot of kind of peers have gone down. I'm curious kind of what was the thinking and mindset behind that?
Yeah. Well, so was starting in 2007, 2008, right? Well, really 2008. And frankly, I was in Boston. I was in grad school at MIT, so we had some VC network. When you go to a technology venture capitalist in 2007 with an idea to sell custom shirts online, he's just like not interested. You know, he's looking for a cure to cancer or, you know, the next Facebook or something. In the early days, direct-to-consumer brands weren't really happening. Custom sounded even more niche than that. It just seemed like a small lifestyle company. Venture capital just wasn't available in the very early days. Once I had launched and had some momentum, maybe there was a deal that could have been done. But at the same time, that's when the economy was just imploding and everybody had cold feet and everything was slow. So then it was maybe an option, but I wasn't pursuing it hard because it wasn't going to be easy. And then from there, maybe in 2009 or late 2009, 2010, I mean, this was a small company. This was myself only. I was the only full-time employee and one developer on contract and a factory. So very low cost, but was starting to break even, so to speak. So at least I was like, okay, I'm not going to die anytime. So it's sustainable. And that was comforting. And if you kept looking, you kept seeing that, yeah, things are slowly growing. So like you just kind of hang on and eventually we'll get to a good place. So you kind of got there and then you're in that kind of middle zone where like venture capitalists are starting to be interested and we had some interest, but they're also kind of like, you don't really have a team. You don't really have a lot of momentum. They're not begging you to take their money. And, you know, my background, I'm an engineer. I prefer to work and build the product and kind of pitching and selling was not really I wasn't super comfortable with that. It wasn't my strong suit. So I just kind of stayed head down, kept building and continued on my way. And then, you know, a few years go by again, and now you really have a real business. You're starting to have a real team. You have real customers. Your manufacturing's amazing. You know, people are starting to hear about it. Now VCs are actually real interested. But at this stage, it's like, no, you're good. Like, you know, no dilution, and you're achieving your dreams. You're setting your own agenda. And you're still growing. You're still doubling every year. So you kind of like lose interest in the VCs. And so that's kind of how we got to where we are. I don't think it's out of the question that we would ever take outside capital like that. I think something might change and we might decide that's the right thing to do. But fundamentally, we stay very busy building the product, optimizing the experience, improving the customer. I mean, we just have our hands full with that. We don't even have time to like think about talking to investors and so it just kind of never happens, but we just continue along and seem to be doing fine.
What's been the most or one of the more challenging parts of this? And then I'll ask what's been the more rewarding part after.
I mean, the first 2 years were super hard. That's when the business was on the verge of, you know, going away every week. And it was a real roller coaster and not a lot of sleep. And, you know, you're borrowing money from friends that you're not sure you're going to be able to pay back. That was a real challenge. That really tests you. And I think beyond that and in general, we have a million challenges. But there's no one big challenge. There was never like, oh, we just got to crack this one thing and then
it's easy going, yeah.
It's like, you know, customer service is hard and scaling technology is hard and dealing with manufacturing's hard, and dealing with shipping's hard, and setting up an office in New York's hard, and every, you know, you have all these challenges, and they all, you just face them all one at a time, I think, and together you solve them, and you know, you move forward and you build a business.
Totally. That success is just solving a lot of little problems.
Exactly.
Sweet. And then rewarding.
Yeah, I mean, well, fundamentally, building a company is just, I think, one of the most rewarding things you can do with your life. And it's been so many amazing things come out of it. I think seeing like a cohesive brand come together, like your website and the marketing materials and how it all flows to the checkout, to the receipts, like, you know, the design nerd in me like loves that. And that's so cool. Seeing employees, you know, we've got had some employees that have been here 4 or 5 years, first job out of school, seeing them develop their careers and become like real experts in their domain, super rewarding. And to kind of help provide a platform for them to achieve, that's amazing. Just going to our customer feedback page, by the way, we have real-time, unfiltered customer feedback on our site, and just to kind of see what reviews come in, and they're like, generally overwhelmingly positive, and there's like a new one every 10 minutes. And just to kind of see like that level of people saying, oh, you know, this is awesome, love what you're doing. That's just a great feeling there. Designing clothes, to me, designing cool clothes, cool products is what I want to do with my life. I find that really fun and interesting. And coming up with a new fabric pattern. We did these flannels out of Italy this fall, winter that were so soft, and getting this melange sort of pattern or color variation and these subtle checks and just making like something beautiful like that. That's so awesome. And then beyond that, being able to sell hundreds of them and see them on the street, I think that's all part of the fun. So
totally. I'm curious to hear kind of how the sourcing and the production shifted from what started domestic to abroad, as some of it is now.
Yeah.
And kind of what drove that shift.
So we started making shirts in North Carolina.
Right.
Small little factory there, owned by Brooks Brothers, actually. Hmm. And worked with them for almost a year. Then we got a call from some family-owned factory in New Jersey that had lots of fabrics that they were stocking, and they were going to offer those to us, and slightly better delivery time and few more options. So we switched and started working with them in New Jersey. Worked with them for about a year. So I have experience working with two shirt factories in the U.S. and great people. It was definitely rewarding and kind of cool to be able to like stop by the factory and see the people there and kind of talk to the people. Love that. But unfortunately, there wasn't a lot of technology in those factories, and there wasn't a lot of automation, and there just wasn't a lot of vision. And my vision was that we were going to streamline and automate this stuff. And I mean, I'm talking about when a factory says, fax me your order one at a time, and you're thinking like, okay, it's fine to get started, but if I'm going to be selling 500 shirts a day, I can't fax you that one at a time. We need to think big.
It's just the line's just busy all day.
We need to integrate. I need to know exactly what's working, and I need an IT group that I can talk to. And so that was a major... There's the factory we work with now is based in Malaysia, very sophisticated group, one of the biggest shirt factories in the world, and a very well-managed operation. Sort of identified them early on as probably an ideal partner, but didn't have the scale and volume to work with them. When we finally got a call from them that they were interested in working together, it was really a no-brainer that if we were going to scale this business, we needed a partner that was going to be sophisticated. The cost goes down slightly by producing custom garments overseas, but actually more than slightly, but the shipping price goes up quite a bit. When you factor it all in, it ends up costing a little bit less to make overseas, but really it was the sophistication, the sort of quality assurance, the just professionally run operation that I think in a smaller American factory that's just not used to dealing with that sort of volume or that sort of customer, they're just not prepared for it. And that's how we ended up with the partner we have now.
Definitely. Do you think that that type of technical innovation is something that can be kind of reclaimed in domestic factories, which is, I mean, today's Trump was inaugurated today. It's obviously an interesting day for this question, but yeah. In terms of, you know, reshoring some of that, do you see that industry kind of updating, or is it really kind of past that opportunity?
That's a great question. Optimistically, I think it's possible. I think the main thing is you just need the right person to do it. You got a third generation family owned factory in America. The guy running that factory probably doesn't know a ton about IT, you know? Like, you just need right. someone.
It's almost a paradox of experience makes him less inclined to actually innovate on
yeah.
it.
Yeah. I sort of fantasize that, hey, maybe someday Proper Cloth, you know, we would get to a point where we would have the scale and the volume. And I think we definitely have the expertise. We could, like, either like partner with some US manufacturer or set up our own or something. But you would really need to question a lot of the assumptions that go into the existing US manufacturing and their processes. And you'd really need to be streamlining things a lot. You'd be investing in a lot of technology to make it. I mean, I think you see it with, I mean, every entrepreneur's hero, Elon Musk, and he just making stuff in the States or, you know, doing yeah, things
just
where,
building rockets in LA.
Yeah. You know, things that everyone would have said is impossible. No, if you have some smart people put their minds to it, it's definitely possible. So I wouldn't count it out. There's only so many people that have that expertise. And if your main goal is to make money, I don't know if the US is the way you would approach that today anyways.
And then finally, where's the name from?
I like the name. I thought it was...
it was good.
I thought it was cool. You know, probably there was like checking to see if the domain name was available and what trademarks were there. Like, I mean, some basic bootstrapping stuff. You couldn't just choose any name and take it. But
Apple shirts.
Yeah. I mean, I thought the name was cool. I liked it and sounded, had a nice ring to it and it stuck.
That's great. Awesome, man. Thanks so much for talking.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Loose Threads podcast. Join the newsletter at loosethreads.com and feel free to leave a review on iTunes. We always appreciate it. It was really cool to hear about the persistence across all aspects of the business that got Proper Cloth to what it is today, and Seth's determination to power through every new obstacle, be it technical, logistical, or creative. We have a great roster of upcoming guests, including Matt Orley from Orley, Amanda Curtis of 19th Amendment, and Andrew Lepofsky of Eponym. Thanks for listening and talk to you soon.